Dory Monson Show on Cairo Radio. This is The Big Lead.
Coming to you from the Carter Subaru Studio. Welcome. Welcome to our top stories this hour. Welcome to The Big Lead. I got a lot of news to get to here, so let's not waste any time at all. Let's get right to The Big Lead.
The Big Lead. Top story.
As we mentioned last week, as we told you about in more detail a couple of hours ago, we have some violent Mexican cartels that are trying to get a foothold here in Seattle, Puget Sound area, and throughout Washington State. It's called the Jalisco New Generation Cartel, CJNG, and some of the good people fighting these cartels are with the DEA. Frank Tarantino is the special agent in charge for the DEA in our region. He joins us live here on the Dory Monson Show. Frank, really appreciate you coming on with me today.
Good afternoon, Dory, and thank you for having me.
My pleasure. So tell me how bad it is, because I've been looking at some of the trend lines for both fentanyl and deaths, and I know that you've been tracking these numbers. How bad is it right now?
Well, you know, Dory, I think what we have to keep in mind is that from a national perspective, we're seeing a pretty consistent increase here in the Pacific Northwest. And let me just clarify, the Seattle Field Division encompasses the states of Washington, Oregon, Idaho, and Alaska. That's what we consider the Pacific Northwest. But specifically, Washington State, we're seeing a very true and accurate representation of what we're seeing on a national scale. And what we're seeing on a national scale is a significant increase, unprecedented increase in overdose deaths. We're approaching 90,000 deaths. And I think it's hard sometimes to visualize or to appreciate what that looks like. But I think the best example I might be able to offer would be that's the equivalent of an Airbus or a jetliner crashing every single day and 250 lives perish as a result of that crash. And we've seen that now for a consistent year time period of overdose deaths in the United States.
Okay, and I know you've been talking about these numbers on a national perspective, but I know that on a more specific level, that you've been talking about how this cartel is trying to get a foothold in Seattle. Do they look at this as a particularly target-rich environment for what they're peddling?
Well, there's no question that we're seeing a significant increase in the distribution and the smuggling of what we consider to be fentanyl-laced counterfeit prescription pills by two main cartel organizations that reside in Mexico, the Sinaloa cartel, and as you mentioned earlier, the CJNG. Both of these cartels are taking advantage of the opioid epidemic and are essentially fueling and perpetuating the opioid epidemic. And we've seen a significant increase, as you mentioned, here in Seattle. In Washington State, for example, we've seized, as an agency, 163 pounds of fentanyl in Washington State alone. That's an increase. That's a 100% increase from last year.
Wow.
So we're seeing a significant spike. And then across the Pacific Northwest, we're seeing a 490% increase. So pretty significant there.
Well, and when you talk about 163 pounds of fentanyl, that is a staggering amount given how little of that drug is needed to kill somebody. I mean, how potent is this fentanyl?
So, you know, I think that's a great point that you bring up, Dory. What's hard to appreciate is the very small quantity that's needed to provide a lethal dose. So what we say in DEA is that 2 milligrams is enough to essentially kill somebody. And what is even more alarming is that DEA, again, on a national scale, 27% of all analyzed synthesized fentanyl-laced counterfeit pills contained a lethal dose of fentanyl.
And when we think about, go ahead.
Yep,
go
sorry. No, I think the other really interesting thing that is worth mentioning, we talk about numbers, is roughly a kilogram of MPP, which is the chemical needed to make fentanyl, can produce about a kilogram. It's a 1-to-1 ratio of fentanyl, and then that same kilogram can be processed even further into a million fentanyl-laced counterfeit pills, which are then smuggled across the U.S. border and up the I-5 corridor and right here into Seattle.
I was starting to say, Agent, I assume I know why they're lacing these drugs with fentanyl. It is so potent, it will produce a much deeper addiction in people. But they don't want to kill off their potential customers, but I assume they're willing to kill off customers to get something that potent out there, and if people die, they just consider that to be collateral damage?
Well, I think that we have to understand that these labs, these super labs that exist in the Sonora state in Mexico, in the Sinaloa cartel and CJNG areas of operation, are not necessarily the same laboratories that we would see here in the United States. And what they're doing is they're co-opting chemists to serve their purposes and make these clandestine counterfeit pills in Mexico with very little oversight and quality control. I'd like to add just real quickly that, you know, the United States government, specifically the Drug Enforcement Administration, which kind of prides itself as the premier drug law enforcement agency in the world, we have 90 offices in 70 different countries, specifically 11 in Mexico alone, and one in every South American country. And we really work on a day-to-day basis to work with our host nation counterparts to cultivate bilateral investigations, meaning joint investigations, where we target significant drug traffickers and organizations in Mexico, and we hold them accountable in their own country, and then we also hold them accountable to the things that they do here in the United States.
A couple other real quick questions. So how are the fentanyl, the heroin, how's it getting into our country? Is it just because our southern border remains so porous?
Well, I think the one thing that we all have to remember is that this is unfortunately a very lucrative business for the traffickers, and they really have an imagination and a unlimited resource of money and tools to get their product to the streets. And they're always trying to cultivate new customers. And I think that's why we're seeing such a significant increase, is that they're trying to find areas that haven't predominantly been hotspots for fentanyl and even meth production or meth distribution. But they're using all means necessary, and they use tunnels. They use body carriers, they use vehicles, they use airlines to get their product to market. So really they're limited by their imagination and they're limited by their resources. And of course they don't have anybody to answer to necessarily. They're not governed by a law like we are.
And then why Seattle? There's a lot of real estate between the U.S.-Mexico border and Seattle, and I have long speculated that the fact that Washington is a sanctuary state is one reason why this is looked at a path of least resistance for getting a foothold. But do you know why Seattle's being targeted?
You know, Dory, I don't know that it's anything different than what we're seeing across the rest of the country. It is so perverse, this widespread pandemic, or this widespread epidemic, I should say, with the fentanyl-laced counterfeit pills, that it's everywhere. And that should concern us all as citizens. And as a parent, I'm a parent of three children. I worry daily about the proliferation of this drug that it's all over the street. So I don't know that it's necessarily specific to Seattle. I think that it's widespread throughout the country. It's coming up the I-5 corridor. It's a perfect route for them to establish new networks, new markets, and then continue to push their product deeper and deeper into the United States.
Okay, and then last thing for you, Agent. You've been very generous with your time. What role, because we have seen a record murder rate for the last 30 years in Seattle and in King County, a lot of that is gang-related. Do the street gangs play a role in the distribution network once the cartels get the product into the region?
Well, yeah, absolutely. You're 100% on point with that, Dory, that these cartels definitely utilize street gangs in the United States to push their product. The cartels are extremely dangerous and lawless in Mexico, and we have attributable and actionable information of some of the atrocities that they've committed in furtherance of their criminal activity in Mexico. In the United States, as mentioned, these gangs, these drug gangs, are pushing the product. Inherently, when you mix drugs with gangs, there's almost always violence associated with those two things. And so when we say there's drugs, we always say there's drugs and guns. There's drugs and guns, and then there's violence. So we definitely see an increase in violence. But the majority of the real heinous crimes and atrocities that are being committed by these cartels are in Mexico, in some of those cartel dominated areas of Mexico.
Wow. Well, I know I speak for a lot of my listeners like you. A lot of us are parents, and God bless the men and women of the DEA and Homeland Security for the job you do, because I know it's dangerous work on your end as well. And I'd love to stay in touch and hear how this battle evolves in the months to come.
Thank you, Dory. I really do appreciate you taking a little time today to help spread our message of remaining vigilant and staying engaged with our youth, and also just being mindful of this really dangerous drug that's perverse and widespread across the city of Seattle and throughout the Pacific Northwest. So thank you again for your time.
All right. Agent Tarantino, really appreciate it, sir. Thank you. He's the DEA special agent in charge in our region. So, you know, that does illustrate a lot of things we've talked about. The murder rate in Seattle and King County. This is not about randomness. It's not about, you know, the COVID economy. This is about warring street gangs. And there is an awful lot of black-on-black crime that happens among the murders in Seattle and King County. And that's because we have a lot of street gangs, and the agent just confirmed that. They become the distribution network once the cartels get the drugs up here. I absolutely believe us being a sanctuary state is a major part of the problem. And then the fact that we have a porous southern border. And, you know, the people, the open borders people, you have to recognize after listening to this that we have in our area hundreds, and in the nation thousands, maybe tens of thousands of people who are dying because the drugs are moving so freely across the border. We have sanctuary cities and states that become the place for the cartels to go because nobody's going to ask any questions, so they don't have to tell any lies. And then you have street gangs that are murdering each other in a bid to get turf for this very lucrative market. As I've said, everything, Jay Inslee making us a sanctuary state, Satterberg making drugs legal in our country, Joe Biden with his open borders policy and telling people to surge the border the first day of his presidency, this is a toxic brew. And when you combine that kind of political messaging with the bloodthirsty, calculated, money-grubbing Mexican cartels, well, then all of a sudden you have a lot of our kids dying around here. And our politicians do not seem to care. Their social goals of transporting as many people who are in this country illegally to our state so we can include them in the census count. We can get more federal money. I mean, it is for such craven reasons why we are sanctioned. It's not about because we want to help immigrants. They aren't immigrants. We admit more legal immigrants than any country on earth every year. And they're a rich part of the tapestry of our nation. I'm talking about people who are illegal aliens, who are not supposed to be in this country, many of them with long criminal records. And that's what we're talking about as the major problem here. Okay, next up in the big lead.
The big lead. I told you so.
Yes, I did tell you that there is a great desire among the government officials who want to control us, who do not want us to get back to the freedom that we had pre-COVID. It is a ridiculous exercise. I'll give you an example. The Seattle Mariners played the Texas Rangers this weekend. They do not require masks among the fans in Texas, in Arlington, where they play. And so everybody in the stands were unmasked. The Texas Rangers were all unmasked. And the Seattle Mariners looked ridiculous as the only people in the stadium wearing masks. And again, it wasn't for public health reasons. It was to put on a show. Hey, look, we're masked up. Aren't we noble? Nah, you just look ridiculous. But they don't want to let that go. By they, I mean the people in charge. Anthony Fauci went on Meet the Press this weekend, and he said, oh yeah, masks might be here to stay.
Okay, let's get to mask wearing, because this is where, you know, at what point can we stop wearing masks outside? At what point, if vaccinated people get together, do you take the masks off? And are we going to, but is the mask going to be something we have with us in a seasonal aspect?
You know, that's quite possible. I think people have gotten used to the fact that wearing masks, clearly, if you look at the data, diminishes respiratory diseases. We've had practically a non-existent flu season this year merely because people were doing the kinds of public health things that were directed predominantly against COVID-19. The Australians during their winter, same thing. They had almost no flu, largely due to the kinds of things, including mask wearing. So it is conceivable that as we go on a year or two or more from now, that during certain seasonal periods, mm-hmm. when you have respiratory-borne viruses like the flu, people might actually elect to wear masks to diminish
no.
the likelihood that you'll spread these respiratory-borne diseases.
No! I'm not going to choose to wear a mask a year or two from now. I'm not going to wear it seasonally for 5 years from now. I'm going to get that mask off as quick as I can. The only time I wear a mask is if I'm inside a business that requires it. When my wife and I were looking at plants on Saturday, everybody in this plant section was masked up, including my wife. Not me. I was outside. I'm not going to wear a mask outside. I refuse to wear a mask outside. I'm vaccinated. Doesn't do me any good. Doesn't do anybody else any good. It's all theater. And when Anthony Fauci says, yeah, we might be doing this for years and years and years, at least seasonally, I don't know who we is, but it ain't me. Because I will not be, doctor. And that is your big lead this hour.
The big lead on Cairo Radio.
Lots more to come. Michelle Obama says she's terrified when her daughters go out to drive. It didn't make any sense, but I'm going to play the audio so you can hear it for yourself. That and also Donald Trump. 2024, the buzz continues. All of that straight ahead on the Dory Monson Show. As you just heard in Aaron's newscast, Pfizer has taken the next step toward getting the vaccine approved for 12 to 15-year-olds. Would you do that as a parent? I mean, maybe you have a kid in that age range. I absolutely would not vaccinate a 12 to 15-year-old, as untested as this vaccine is at this point. I vaccinated myself. I told you, I talked to all my daughters. All three of them were here for Mother's Day. I'm sorry, Birthing People's Day. Two have been vaccinated, one has not. They're all adults. They all can make their own decision. And I don't have a strong feeling at their age about the vaccine either way. I do have really strong feelings about 12-year-olds. They don't need it. And we shouldn't be injecting stuff into them. And then the other thing I discovered, I got vaccinated up in Snohomish County a few weeks ago. And yesterday we got the billing that went to our insurance company. I thought it was free for I honestly did not know this. They said the vaccine is going to be free for everybody. Well, free means, of course, that the federal government is funneling billions and billions of dollars to the pharmaceutical companies. But it just is amazing to me when it comes to our children that people don't trust pharmaceutical company CEOs. They trust politicians even less. And when pharmaceuticals and politicians get together, they say, oh, yeah, inject that in my child. But seriously, I'd love to hear from you. You can text me at 98973. Are you going to get your 12, 13, 14, 15-year-old vaccinated? Because I would not. I got myself vaccinated, but the risk-reward is far different at my age than for a 12-year-old. And if everybody's going to do this just because under the coercive threat of government, well, if you want to get on an airplane, if you want to go to a sporting event, want to go to a restaurant, you better do what the pharmaceutical CEOs and the politicians tell you to do. This is a scary path down which we are traveling. So shoot me a text. Let me know. 98973. If you have a 12 to 15. I'm just looking at the text. That's just the first one I see. No bleeping way. From the 206. I have two teenagers. They are getting vaccinated. Risk reward is the same at 12. I would vaccinate. No, it's not the same at 12. There's no way the risk reward. 12-year-olds don't get sick. You know, there's the one in a million exception. 12-year-olds don't get sick. 80-year-olds can die. Don't tell me the risk reward is the same, regardless of your age. I'm closer to 80 than I am to 12. But I'm not very close to 80. I'm not that old. Although 80's the new 70. So 80's not old. But I would not vaccinate my 12-year-old. But I'd love to hear from you, 98973. I had some audio that I wanted to share with you. Michelle Obama was on CBS Morning News. And I think this is very dangerous propaganda that Michelle Obama is pushing out. She was talking about how frightened she is as a parent when her daughters go out to drive.
Everything about them, the fact that they are good students and polite girls, but maybe they're playing their music a little loud. Maybe somebody sees the back of their head and makes an assumption. I, like so many parents of black kids, have to, that the innocent act of getting a license puts fear in our hearts.
Okay, time out. It's not just black parents. Getting a license, when your kids do that, it puts fear in every parent's heart. And the truth is that your kids, my kids, when they were that age, they were tens of thousands of times more likely to die, probably hundreds of thousands of times more likely to die in a car accident than at the hands of police, or because they're texting while they're driving. Secondly, Michelle Obama does not have to worry about profiling for at least the next 5 years. Her daughters will get round-the-clock Secret Service protection. She doesn't have anything to worry about when her girls go out driving. As I said, if they do, it's because of distracted driving or other people on the road. But she wants to continue the narrative, and no matter the color of your skin, if you do not run, fight with, challenge, try to hit with your car the police, you're going to be fine. But Michelle Obama wants to keep pushing out this very dangerous narrative. And I say it's dangerous because it creates in the minds of far too many people that they do have to run from the police. They do have to fight. They don't have to cooperate, or they shouldn't cooperate. And that's what's getting people killed, is that mentality, more than if you do everything right and have your hands at 10 and 2 and answer all the questions, you're fine.
So I think we have to talk about it more, and we have to ask our fellow citizens to listen a bit more, mm-hmm. and to believe us,
yes.
and to know we don't want to be out there marching. I mean, all those Black Lives Matter kids, they'd rather not have to worry about this. They're taken to the streets because they have to. They're trying to have people understand that we're real folks. And the fear that many have of so many of us is irrational, and it's based on a history that is.
No, that's interesting. The fear so many people have of us is irrational. I would say the fear that so many people have of cops is irrational. And I'm confident that is far more true.
It's sad and it's dark, and it's time for us to move beyond that.
Okay. And yes, we should move beyond the irrational fear of cops and creating an atmosphere where you're trying to tell kids that they have to be confrontational to survive an encounter with a cop. It's a very dangerous message, but all this is very calculated, the danger that's pushed out there. Okay, quick time out, then we'll count down our favorite sound bites of the day. Awesome audio is coming up next. Stretch we come. What a day, what a show, what a show, what a day. And this is the time of day when we like to count down our favorite sound bites of the day.
This is Dory Monson's awesome audio clips of the day.
I did something I never do this weekend. I actually recorded and then watched Saturday Night Live. I was curious. Elon Musk was going to be the guest host. There was all this talk that some of the cast members were going to boycott the show because Elon Musk didn't come around to the whole COVID storyline until a few months in. And they also don't like how rich he is. That's right. They were going to boycott the show because he's too rich, they said. The funny thing was, Elon Musk was the funniest guy on the show. The rest of that cast, I haven't seen Saturday Night Live in ages. The rest of that cast is dismal. They are just awful. And so Elon Musk was really the high. And then the other thing, they do their opening piece, and then they, live from New York, Saturday Night Live. And then they show all the cast members starring. It used to be about, 6 or 7. They have like 20, 25 cast members, and it goes on forever. These opening credits, and they're all people no one has heard of, nobody cares about, nobody needs to see them in opening credits. It's a bad show. But Elon Musk, he was kind of self-effacing when he said stuff like this?
It's an honor to be hosting Saturday Night Live. I mean that. Sometimes after I say something, I have to say, I mean that. So people really know that I mean it. That's because I don't always have a lot of intonation or variation in how I speak. Which I'm told makes for great comedy. I'm actually making history tonight as the first person with Asperger's to host SNL.
And they said, well, the first one who admits it anyway. He said, of course, he is not a normal human being.
Look, I know I sometimes say or post strange things, but that's just how my brain works. To anyone I've offended, I just want to say, I reinvented electric cars and I'm sending people to Mars in a rocket ship. Did you think I was also going to be a chill, normal dude?
That's a pretty good line. Yeah, the man is worth $166 billion. Tesla has a bigger market cap than many Dow 30 companies. I thought this was, he was talking about how he smoked weed when he was on Joe Rogan's podcast. A lot of people were down on him for that. But I like this reference that he made, too.
A lot of times, people are reduced to the dumbest thing they ever did. Like one time, I smoked weed on Joe Rogan's podcast. And now, all the time I hear, Elon Musk, all he ever does is smoke weed on podcasts. Like I go from podcast to podcast, lighting up joints. It happened once. It's like reducing O.J. Simpson to murderer. That was one time. Fun fact, O.J. also hosted this show in 79. And again, in 96, killed both times.
Killed both times. So that was funny. That was all funny there. And then his mom came out on stage with him.
Mom, do you remember when I was 12 and I created my own video game called Blastar about a spaceship that battles aliens?
I do. I remember they paid you $500. But you were too young to open a bank account, so I had to open one for you.
That's right. Whatever happened to that bank account?
That's not important. You turned that video game about space into reality.
Unless you consider that our reality might be a video game and we're all just computer simulations being played by a teenager in another planet.
Because that is one of the things that Elon Musk has tossed out, that we are not in base reality right now, that we are just being manipulated in a huge video game. All right. Also in our awesome audio, Roger Daltrey of The Who, he says that cancel culture is creating a miserable world.
It's becoming so absurd now with the AI doing all the tricks it can do and the woke generation. It's terrifying the miserable world they're going to create for themselves. I mean, anyone who's lived a life and you see what they're doing, you just know that it's a route to nowhere. Especially when you've lived through the periods of a life that we've had the privilege to. I mean, we've had the golden era. There's no doubt about that. But we came out of a war. We came out of a leveled society, completely flattened bomb sites and everything. And we built that. We've been through socialist governments. We've seen the communist system fail in the Soviet Union. I've been in those communist countries while they were communists. I've seen how wonderful, really, it was.
You know, I like the reference by Roger Daltrey. We've been fooled by communism and socialism in the past. We can get fooled again by all of that stuff. But by the way, I don't think they ever would have allowed The Who's song My Generation in 2021. It makes fun of stuttering. Okay, I got to get out of here. Tom Curley Show's coming up next. God bless you in these crazy times, and I'll see you back here tomorrow. High noon.
You can't be nasty today.
Oh, God.
God, is that today?
I reminded you last night.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. You're really a fantastic audience.